Welcome to another conversation with Master Chow. Questions being asked by Alan. Alan, if you'd like to say hello for the recording.
Hello, everybody.
And Alan, I think today's subject was New Age.
That's correct.
So it'll be interesting to see what your questions are. So, next voice you'll hear will be Chow's. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Master Chow. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
So, what are we talking about today?
Well, today's subject is the New Age.
Oh, as opposed to the Old Age.
I think that's right. Yes, the New Age movement.
Ah, better to put the word movement in there, I think.
Yes, well, that was actually the first question, which is, how does Spirit view the New Age movement? I mean, we tend to see it as a movement that embraces all things spiritual and also includes what we would typically classify as various types of paranormal phenomena, but how do you see it?
I think it's the use of the word spiritual that always throws things off a little bit. So spiritual, from our point of view, is the reality that you are part of the spirit realm, part of us, as well as existing within the physical realm. You have a fragment of spirit within you, that's your soul. So for us, spirituality stems around that understanding, the understanding that you are a spirit being having a human incarnation. So spiritual, when it comes into the guise of New Age, tends to wander a little bit as to quite what they are using it for. Whether they are using it to mean being more mindful and more present and more self-aware with yoga, mindfulness, meditation, or whether it is more about communicating and connecting to things that are beyond your physical realm, such as spirit. So New Age as a subject doesn't really have much of an anchor for us on our side, on the spirit side. It very much is a human-driven thing. It's something you have coined as a sentient being. So we respect that, and we understand that, but we also see that it doesn't really always mean the same thing for everyone who uses the phrase.
Right.
So as a movement, it is very much human-driven, not spirit-driven. So we respect that you have it, and we focus in on the different aspects of it, ones that relate to spirit, but we don't see the movement as a thing we need to be involved in.
Right, okay. Right, thank you. So when did the New Age start? Because, I mean, many people would equate its beginnings perhaps to the flower power era of the 1960s, you know, with the Beatles and what have you. Although some people, of course, consider it commenced around the time of the millennium, which many believe to be the start of the Age of Aquarius. I mean, how mature is it?
Well, the use of the phrase New Age definitely goes back to, as you put it, flower power time. The 60s and 70s of the last century, the middle years, were when it was originally coined as a phrase by humans. But if you look at what New Age means in itself as the two words, then that's why it then gets brought up again with the Age of Aquarius, with the shifting in how you measure time, and also how you consider yourselves evolving. So both are right. But they aren't both necessarily talking about the movement. So the movement is more starting the middle of last century. So the 1900s, that's more where the movement started from. The idea of a new age, two separate words, more to do with the Aquarius and the shifting of consciousness. So again, you see, you put them all in the same basket. And they don't live all in the same basket. but they have a relationship to each other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, when would you define the start of the age of Aquarius, though?
But we wouldn't.
Right.
Again, it's very much a human measuring of time. We're spirit, we don't have any time, so we don't measure it like that.
Mm.
So it's more your measurement than ours.
Right, right. I mean, presumably there is an overlap, though, isn't there, between the ending of the age of the Pisces and the start of Aquarius?
Yes, but again, both of those things are driven by how you measure your time, not by spirit.
Mm.
We didn't come down one day and go, hello, it's the first day of Pisces. We didn't even come down and tell you, this is Pisces. These things are all coming from human structures, human ways of how you need to recognize time, or if you look at the horoscopes, how you recognize personality traits, whether that be Pisces and Aquarius, or whether that be Tiger and Ox. These are ways of looking at cyclical behaviors and cyclical patterns. These are coming from human consciousness, not spirit consciousness.
Right, okay, thank you. Right, so we'll do a bit of a round the houses now and just look briefly at each aspect of the New Age and perhaps ask you to tell us what you think. So the first subject I thought would be a good one would be angels, very popular in the New Age.
See, but they don't have anything to do with the New Age. I mean, if you think about them, they're very old age. I mean, they go into your Bibles, and I say Bibles because you know it's not all the same book, but your books of many of your religions talk about messengers from their gods.
Mm.
So the idea of the angels is far earlier than the New Age movement.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. But it is an important part of the New Age in the way that people embrace it and relate to it, or at least believe themselves to do. I mean, many people see them in a Christian context and believe in them to be exalted beings who belong to a divine hierarchy.
Yeah.
But what is their true origin and their relationship to humanity?
Well, their true origin is they are spirit.
Right.
So, firstly, it's important to understand that angels do not operate outside of the spirit realm. So they're not like a separate thing. They are part of spirit. They are merely spirit beings that have a collective identity which you recognize as angelic.
Mm.
And what that means is that all those spirit beings have had an experience as the same place or time or nature. So they all have a resonance that is what's classed as angelic. So you will understand that at the moment you are all having the human experience.
Mm. Yeah.
But this is not the first physical life form spirit has taken. It's just the current one. So a previous one is what all the angelics were. They all collectively had experiences in that physical life form. And collectively, that's what bonds them all together. So they have had human experience. No, they've not had. I get my words muddled today. They have not had human experience. They have had physical experience. That's right. Get it right, child. So they've had physical experience, not human experience, but all the same physical form.
Mm.
Did that make sense?
So they have lived in the physical universe?
Yes, but all the same place.
Right.
So that's what bonds them together. So they've had a collective idea of what it was to be physical, but not the nuance of being human.
Mm.
Okay.
Right.
So that's what brings them all together as a collective. But equally, they could individually break out and be just spirit beings that connect and speak to you if they wish. But they like to work as a collective, as a cohesive unit, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
Because it helps humanity if you have a similar signature that you can keep referring to. You do like patterns and order and continuity. So that group have been speaking to humanity and assisting humanity for a very long time. That's why they keep popping up in your religious texts.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, of course, that connection is then couched or framed in the nature of the religious text. So, of course, in the Christian ideology, they are messengers of God.
Mm.
But they are all collectively spirit beings who have shared the same physical type of incarnation, and who collectively all want to assist humanity. So they have the shared recognition of a physical form and the experiences existed there, and the desire to help humanity. Because not all spirits want to help humanity, but they do. And that's why collectively they appear to have a similar signature. They use that as a way to assist humanity in trusting them.
Okay. I mean, the archetypal images that we have for angels, I mean, does that serve any useful purpose?
It's rather nice. I think it's a rather pretty image.
They
rather like using it too. I mean, of some of the images you have portrayed spirit as, it's one of the nicer ones.
Mm.
So they rather like it, and they will use it because it's something that you like.
Mm.
We will always show ourselves in ways that suit you. So the whole winged creature thing suits humanity. We don't mind. They don't mind. They like to do it. But they are energy like the rest of us. So they can choose to be seen like that, or they can choose to be seen in their true form, which would be pure energy.
Right. Okay, thank you. Right, our next question then is, what do you think about the concept of ascension? And again, this is another very popular subject in the New Age. Many people aspire to ascend, and some people even believe that they have achieved it. But what is ascension? And is this something that can be attained by a human soul incarnated in the physical world?
Well, we have to now say and ask you, how long is your piece of string?
Right.
Because if you look at the history of the discussion of ascension, it used to be about seeking enlightenment.
Mm.
And a lot of your master teachers that you would recognize were all seeking to be enlightened, to come to a point of pure understanding that they were both spirit and human, walking a human incarnation to learn, and to learn from that understanding, to have been masters of themselves, to know themselves truly, and to embrace this life fully before they return home.
Right.
That was enlightenment. But enlightenment sort of lost its shine somewhere along the line. And you started to then seek this new idea of ascension. And ascension actually hasn't to do with humanity. It has to do with spirit. It's more a way we describe our own passage through the spirit realm from one level of learning to another, that we ascend through ourselves. So ascension really has more of a place within the spiritual identity than it does within the physical identity.
Right.
Okay. So trying to attain ascension is not really something the humans are supposed to be doing.
But it sounds as if enlightenment is perhaps about our limit, is it?
Well, it's not about a limit. It's about you're here in a physical form. When you look at how they discuss ascension, they are trying to step away from the physical form.
Mm.
But the whole point is, we've chosen to come down and be in this physical form. We don't want you to step out of it. That's returning home.
Mm.
To ascend, to arise from one plane to another, well, that's just a way of describing the homeward-bound journey. Has nothing to do with how much learning you had achieved.
Right.
So there's a bit of a mixture going on here with the idea. We don't want you to step out of being human. We want you to fully embrace being human and actually do it better.
Right.
So enlightenment isn't a second choice. Enlightenment is the one we are trying to help you achieve. And actually your world would be much better for it if you achieve that level of self-awareness. You would treat your planet and each other a lot better if you were enlightened. But ascension is pushing it further than that. It's pushing it into something that takes you away from being physical, takes you away from being grounded in this life. And there's a lot of escapism in that. There's a lot of trying to detach because life is too hard. But life is too hard because you're sat in suffering, because you're not embracing your human experience and walking your path. So ascension as an idea isn't very helpful. It can really push some of you even further off your path and take you much further away from any sort of peace. It's a very difficult one because there's a lot of delusion and illusion and a lot of spiritual ego wrapped up in the idea of ascension. Eventually you will all ascend, because eventually you will all die, leave your physical bodies, and your soul will ascend back into the spirit plane. But that's just a normal process. There's nothing superior or stunning or magnificent about that. You do it all the time. So we have to be careful with this whole ascension thing. It's driving people to try to step away from their bodies, as if your body is a terrible thing.
It's a form of escapism, isn't it?
Absolutely. We, you know, enlightenment is a wonderful thing. We wish enlightenment would come back into fashion.
Yeah.
And rather than ascension.
Right, okay. This now, the next question may or may not be related to ascension, but who are the ascended masters? I mean, can we see help and advice from them? I mean, how do they interact with humanity if they even exist?
But they are just teachers. So if you consider the idea of enlightenment is that they have attained a level of self-mastery and self-understanding. That's what to be enlightened is. Okay, so some of you have achieved that. So some of those who have achieved it are now stepping forward from spirit's side to help others achieve it. So an ascended master is merely someone who reached a point within enlightenment, not necessarily the absolute zenith of it, but a reasonable way along the path, who are now trying to help other humans reach that same level of self-mastery. So they step together collectively under the identity of ascended master.
Right.
So, but they are all vibrationally very different because they all have their own personalities and quirks based on how they got to that point, because they didn't all do it in exactly the same way.
Right.
So they are an interesting bunch and they vary in persona quite a bit.
How do they interact with us though?
Well, same as any spirit does. They just talk to you and say hello. It's not complicated. They speak exactly the same as angelics do, just no wings. So it's no different to any spirit. They're just collectively working for a different goal.
Right, so if you invite the communication, they would step forward?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, they might not suit everybody. I mean, there's horses for courses. I like that saying. I think that saying is quite funny. So some of you will like them, some of you won't. Some of you will like angels, some of you won't. The whole thing is you have to find the ones that resonate for you. But unless you know yourself, how do you know what resonates? Yeah. So it always comes back to you need to know yourself. So try them on for size. Meet them. Say hello. Sometimes a little bit of a funny idea is to consider it like spiritual dating. You know, do you like them? Don't you like them? If you like them, get to know them a bit better. If you don't like them, swipe, move on to the next one. They won't be offended.
Okay. And again, perhaps partly related to this, although perhaps more earthy. What about gurus and other New Age teachers? I mean, like any movement, the New Age has a number of individuals who are recognised as being both the teachers and leaders in their particular field. I mean, what do you think about the general quality of what is being taught and how misleading are some of the teachings?
But it's like anything. If they haven't done the self-work, if they haven't truly invested the time in dealing with their own ego and their own personal issues, because you all have them, you know, you've all had experiences that have marked you in some way, whether they are traumas or whether they are just bad days, there are bits and pieces within you that you need to work out, your light and your shadow. If they haven't done all of that work, then they can be inadvertently misleading. I say inadvertently because there are always a few who are deliberately misleading, the charlatans. No profession is immune to that. But there are a lot who are misleading but don't know they are misleading them people. They believe in what they're saying because that's their truth. And if other people acknowledge it, then that affirms their truth. So it's not deliberately misleading, but it can be. So if they are off path, then they will pull people into that idea if it suits where those people are, because it allows them to avoid something or upholds their denial or the illusion that they might be in.
Well, that brings me nicely on to the next question then, of how big a problem is confabulation. Obviously this relates to some of the individuals that you were talking about. I mean, I'm defining confabulation here as a process whereby a person falls prey to self-induced false memories. So this would be the implanting of a memory of an experience that relates to something that they would like to believe is true, but which never actually happened in reality. But it does seem to me there's quite a lot of this sort of thing going on in the New Age, when people become victims of their own confabulation for one reason or another.
I don't know that there's a lot of it going on. I think define a lot. I think there is definitely some of that going on, particularly around the idea of past life memories. That's a whole box of tricks that can be very easily manipulated in the wrong direction without meaning to or with meaning to. So I don't think there's a lot of false memories deliberately floating around. But I think, you know, the human mind is such a wonderful thing. Your imagination is such a wonderful thing. It's an amazing piece of design. And you really don't understand a lot about how your own brains work, that you can fall foul of the magnificence that your own mind can create.
Mm, yeah.
A trauma can create all sorts of issues with memories. It can withhold memories. It can also skew a memory. How you think about a memory can change how you relate to it. So your own minds are not understood well enough, and that does cause problems. I think deliberately implanting memories from the point of view of the New Age movement, if we come back to the subject, there's not so much of it deliberately happening.
Mm.
There is some of it happening through ill-conceived ideas.
But I was also thinking as well, in relation to individuals who are susceptible to stepping into trance states more easily, and then in this more suggestible state of mind, their own subconscious can create a whole scenario of events.
But you're not talking
then
about the trance
your memory
state. But hold on, be careful with the language there. You're not talking a trance state, you're talking the state that is used for hypnosis.
Yeah.
So, be careful with the word trance.
That
big word, lots of different definitions. So within the state of consciousness that's used for hypnosis, some people are more susceptible and suggestible than others. That is a reality. So that's down to the quality of the person who you allow to put you into that state and their own integrity. So buyer beware. Do your homework. Know why you are doing it. So it's possible to do it, but to a smaller percentage of the population than you might think.
Right.
Not everybody is susceptible to that.
Oh, but no, it is a small minority.
It is a small minority. And then a small minority of practitioners who might inadvertently do it through their own desire to help you. The uncovering of false memories because they think there is a memory there and then they get you to agree with them. It's very careful. They have to be very, very careful. And this is why good training is required. So susceptibility is something to be considered from the person's point of view before they embark on having these types of sessions. Are they susceptible? Are they going in with a clear idea of what they want to achieve? Are they going in to escape their own trauma and it's not there for that? They should be seeking other type of therapy to assist with that. But if we go back to the question of gurus, we were talking about the fact that there are ones out there who are misleading people unintentionally.
Yeah.
But there are also some who are guiding people from a very good place. So you have to then look at the idea of what is a guru. And a guru is someone who brings light into your darkness. So that's all a guru is. They give you enlightenment in that sense. They give light to your darkness. But you could equally say that a very good qualified therapist does that for someone who is in their own trauma. So guru as a very broad word, there are lots of people who are doing that who are not seen as spiritual teachers, who do not put themselves on pedestals.
Right.
Guru in the sense of the spiritual teacher, the one that everyone is an acolyte to, or a devotee to, then you have to be very careful. Where is that person's ego? Because they might start out very humbly, but they can run foul of supply and demand, of cause and effect. And when a lot of people are seeking your wisdom and adulation, it can trip you up if you aren't very certain of yourself. So guru should always absolutely know who they are and have dealt with their own personal issues before they go to preach or teach.
Right, okay. Well, thank you. Right, our next question is, what's your view of astral projection? Because as you probably know, many people down here see this as a very desirable thing to be able to escape the limitations of the physical body and to be able to travel anywhere in the physical world and perhaps to even visit the astral realm. But what do you consider to be the true purpose of astral projection?
Well, that's a difficult one because we would not regard it as astral projection.
Right.
There are times at which you travel into the astral plane to speak to your own guides and teachers. And it doesn't happen to everybody and it doesn't happen all the time. But sometimes it's the best way to have a really good conversation. And it will happen often in the dream state. You might wake up having had a very vivid dream. And that's just how you are recalling the experience. some of the very deep level teachings that have to occur will occur in that type of scenario, because we can impart more information quickly than with you being in a more conscious state.
Mm.
So sometimes traveling into the astral plane is used for that. Projecting yourself astrally, so moving your astral body out of the rest of your physical body at your own conscious willing of it in order to wander around, well, then we have to sort of start asking you why. If it's to come up to the astral plane to speak to your guides and there's a purpose for that, then okay. But when it's to merely wander around the rest of your physical plane, we do sort of have to wonder what for. And it can be used for good, but it can also be used for not so good.
Mm.
For looking in places where you have no permission to look.
Yeah, spying on people.
You said it. I was avoiding the word. You know, that's because you can go and look in a window does not mean you should. And just because you can travel around the world in your astral body does not mean that you should. It has to come down to personal integrity and the intent behind it. So the astral body is capable of moving outside of the rest of the subtle bodies around the physical and the astral plane. But it doesn't come without its risks. You can overextend yourself, you can exert yourself and leave the rest of the bodies vulnerable from an energetic point of view and an exhaustion point of view. And also you can get lost in it because, again, it's another form of escapism if you are not careful. So you don't need to think why you want to do it. And curiosity is not really a good enough answer. Mm. You do need to have a purpose that honors who you are, but also honors those who you might be encountering deliberately or inadvertently while you are wandering around in an astral state. So it does require a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. And it is not something spirit would encourage people to do willy-nilly. You know, we do sometimes bring you up to the astral plane because there is a purpose for it. So it's very purposeful, there is an intent, there are safeguards in place, and there is usually a lot of information to be passed over in a small space of time, and that's why we would do it.
Mm. Okay. So perhaps related partly to this, though, I'm not sure about this. What is the truth of the near-death experience? I mean, what is this?
Mm. Well, near-death is what it says on the ticket, really. It's where the body has at some point stopped, the heart has stopped, but perhaps brain function hasn't completely stopped, or has stopped to the point at which it doesn't register on your devices, but it hasn't completely, absolutely stopped. So there are instances then where the soul begins to feel it's time to go home, time to return to spirit, to follow the protocols that are in place for that. But there is a shift then back. The body starts breathing, the heart starts pumping, and the soul is back in place. But there is a shift in perception for a moment where the human side of you has the recall of what the soul experienced, which you normally don't have, because normally you don't come back to life. So therefore you don't have it in a physical sense. So near death can be quite literal, as in the soul has started to get ready to depart. It can be more cusp orientated. So cusp orientated is where perhaps the life or death question isn't as cut and dried. So the soul might be able to choose to continue its journey home or choose to return because it's not time yet. Because of the nature of free will. So the nature of free will means we have to factor in chaos. So though there are plans in place for when perhaps a soul might return to spirit, the chaos that exists within the physical plane can sometimes alter that, take them out of the equation back home sooner than necessary. Mm. Cusp. So then sometimes there is a point at which they can return. The body hasn't decayed in any way, that the fraction of time that's passed on your plane allows the soul to come back in and continue, but come back in and the physical body retains some memory of that shift.
Right. But what about the experience that so many people have where they travel down this tunnel of light and they're greeted by a deceased relative or perhaps a more exalted being such as an angel and then later on have to come back to their physical bodies? I mean, what's actually happening here?
Well, that is what happens when you pass. That the tunnel of light is slightly stylized, but the soul knows to go to the light. We have to give it some sort of predetermined information so it returns home. Okay. So the idea of going to the light is true. The tunnel, when it gets very tunnel-orientated, that's human poetic license, if you like.
Mm.
Being greeted by past relatives, that's perfectly normal. That's what would happen to a soul. But also, once you know that's what is normal, your mind can also create that.
Mm.
So some near-death is a manufacture of your brain trying to understand what the body is going through.
Right, right.
But it's a percentage. It's not the total of them. So near-death experiences aren't always actual near-death from a soul perspective. Sometimes they're near-death from a physical perspective because your mind can create that image because that's what it's expecting to see.
Yeah,
your subconscious can do it if it's trying to rationalize something during the healing process. So particularly those who have gone into any sort of deep coma or there is a brain injury might have those sorts of recollections, which is actually your subconscious trying to give you the impetus, if you want, to stay or go. To make the choice, you have free will. It's a free will choice then.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's not always the soul driving it. Sometimes it's your subconscious driving it. Sometimes it's just pure theatre.
Right, okay. What's your view of lucid dreaming? I mean, many people see that as a very wonderful thing to wake up and dream and take control of it. It does seem the gateway to an exciting fantasy life, if nothing else.
But then is that also the risk? If the fantasy is better than the reality, is that really good for you?
Mm.
To have a fantasy can be a nice thing to lift your mood, but if your life is so different from the fantasy, then you are, in a sense, traumatizing yourself every time you return. But not resolving what is wrong with the reality to make it better.
Mm.
So all of these things that take you away from an uncomfortable or absolutely terrible physical life don't necessarily make it better. They just give you a place to escape to.
But don't you think they make it more tolerable?
But do they make it more tolerable? Surely the life seems crueler and crueler every time you return to it. So I should imagine the time space between going to the fantasy world and coming back gets shorter and shorter.
Mm, all right.
Because the contrast is stronger and stronger.
Mm.
But how does that help you resolve what is going on in the physical life? Now, from a therapeutic point of view, however, lucid dreaming can be a very powerful tool when dealing with psychological trauma, things like PTSD, things where traumatic memories are an issue. You could constructively use lucid dreaming then to heal.
Yeah, yeah.
But as an escape, that is a double-edged sword. Mm. People need to consider why are they escaping and can they not improve the situation, put their effort into healing.
Right, okay. I mean, is a dream an inward movement of consciousness into the subconscious or is it some sort of outward projection?
It can be both. It really does depend on how it's being driven. I mean, during sleep, dreaming is a subconscious activity. It's a processing, if you like, of the events of the day or of several days. It's, if you like, accessing the processing that's running all the time in your subconscious mind. But lucid dreaming shifts that, so could shift it into being more conscious inwardly or outwardly. Depends on the practitioner and the intent. Always comes down to intent. You have to be very clear about your intent.
Okay, thank you. So what's your view of subliminal learning? So I'm thinking here about these audio recordings that contain subliminal messages which are given to the person during sleep, obviously with a view to influencing the subconscious. Mm-hmm. I mean, is this in any way effective or is it dangerous?
It can be effective for some things. Your subconscious mind can be a sponge. So it can bring in information that at other points you can recall. So you can subliminally learn some things, but it's the nature of the thing. Being able to know a thing is not the same as being able to do a thing. You will have no muscle memory of it. So for instance, if you subliminally learned how to fly a plane, you may have the detail, but your body wouldn't have the memory of it. So your reflexes, your ability to apply the knowledge would be hampered. So subliminal learning is a functionality. There are areas in which this is proven to occur. But the effectiveness of it and the benefits of it, there's less proof in the pudding, shall we say. So yes, your subconscious can absorb information subliminally, and actually it's doing it all the time from your media. You just don't realize it. You're not consciously listening to a lot of the sound that is around you, but your subconscious mind is taking it in. So you're subliminally learning things without people actually deliberately directing what it is you're learning. That's slightly more worrying. So you might suddenly be able to hum a tune to something and wonder where you learnt it.
Yes.
So the idea of subliminal learning is a fact. It's how the brain works. Targeting it and focusing it to make it effective and useful, that really depends on what it is you are trying to teach. So things that are knowledge-based, that don't have application-based requirements, can be quite good. So languages can be quite good, but you still have to learn how to make the sound.
Yeah,
but that's slightly easier than learning how to mechanically do something with arms and legs and eye coordination. So it does depend on the what.
Right, okay. Right, our next question is, what is channeling? Is this just another word for transmediumship, or is it perhaps a lighter form of trance? What issues surround the use of channeling?
So channeling has sort of come up with the New Age movement, because it's time-wise, it's come into the necessary vocabulary of mediumship. So transmediumship being the oldest form, mental mediumship, or what you would know as clairvoyance, then really coming to the forefront because of the two world wars and the sudden need for proof of survival. But now there is a much greater need for guidance, for wisdom, for philosophy, and transmediumship on its own simply cannot deliver the quantities. And effectively, you know, trance is very specialized. So channeling is a lighter form of transmediumship. It's easier to learn. It's easier to do for the physical body. It's less demanding. So it is the most recent member of the mediumship family.
Right, okay.
But unfortunately, the word does get used quite a lot to describe lots of things that are not necessarily the accurate use of the word. So one should always query the actuality of what someone is doing when they are using the word. Because it may just be they don't know all the vocabulary to accurately describe what they're doing. So there may be a mismatch in vocabulary, but not a mismatch in the intent, or indeed in the quality of what they are doing. Just what they are calling it might be a mismatch.
Okay. Right, thank you. Right, our next question then is, what is extrasensory perception? Because this seems to be like an umbrella term covering a whole range of things beyond the normal five senses.
But ESP again...
And we'll have things like telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, psychic perception, remote viewing, mediumship, all chopped into this phrase.
But they don't. So ESP predates the New Age movement. So extrasensory perception predates your mid-century movement as such. The idea that the human mind and brain is capable of so much more, you use such a small percentage of it, is a reality. Your brain is capable of a lot more than you use it for. So some of those ideas around what the brain might be capable of if it was fully tapped into would sit in your telepathy, telekinesis, precognition. Precognition does occur. Limited, but it does occur. Some people do get a very good sense of what's about to happen in the future. It tends to be more immediate, and it tends to be based around very dramatic things, because they send out a louder signal. It's about, if you like, they're a bit like a human radar.
Right.
So if there's a big enough noise, they pick it up. So the small things they might not pick up, but the very big world things they might pick up. That's precognition.
Mm-hmm.
Telepathy, the idea of hearing thoughts, well, yes, if your brains were functioning more, if you were using the greater depths of their capacity, there is an argument for that being plausible. Telekinesis, though, unfortunately, I think that's one step too far.
Right.
And I think with good reason. I don't think the world would be a very safe place if you could all do that.
Mm.
But telepathy in limited ways, I think you do it anyhow through a sense of empathy. You are aware of what someone is thinking, even if you're not actually hearing their thoughts. You read micro expressions. You energetically pick things up from them psychically. I think there is an element of that that already occurs. Mothers, for instance, know when the baby is hungry without looking. There's a connection there. That's a form of telepathy in some ways.
Mm.
So I think you are capable of more if you were to use your bodies and your tools that it had to their full potential.
Right. Okay. I mean, is the development of ESP part of a natural evolution, would you say?
It sits within part of your survival instinct. I mean, psychic is about your survival instinct. It's about knowing that something is dangerous, something is a threat. So from the point of view of when you had predators that were hunting you, it was important that you had good instincts. Once you have taken away the predators and your instincts have nothing to work on, they start then to be able to be applied to other things. So there is scope to develop that as part of your innate instinctive awareness. But it is better when it is survival-based, because there is already an imperative for that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we come back to, is it just about being curious and nosy? That's not so good.
Mm-hmm.
So the why is always important with these things. And also the fact that your human bodies have room to evolve. You know, as a species, you do have adaptability and potential for evolvement, for future growth and alteration, which most of your other animal species don't. They've already reached the peak point of their particular genetic markers. You haven't. So there is the potential for the human form, the body, the brain and everything, to take a leap into a slightly different form that was more efficient.
Right.
And used more brain capacity, etc. But you didn't make that leap. So you leapt from, you know, Neanderthal man and so on and so forth. You've made these leaps before. But then you sort of came to the model you've got now and you haven't really leapt again. But the potential is there within the genetic material to make a leap. You just haven't.
Okay, that's interesting. Thank you. Right, next question then. How do you view the concept of positive thinking? Again, this is another popular topic in the New Age movement.
Yes.
The general belief is that positive thinking can create new and desirable conditions in a person's life, or overcome negativity, or even that negativity itself can be affirmed out of existence.
Well, the idea that you can affirm negativity out of existence is going too far.
Mm.
I mean, negativity is there for a purpose. You cannot have positive without negative. You cannot have one without its opposite. So the idea of positive thinking is both sound and flawed. So the idea, if you take it at its core, is that a positive thought will uplift you.
Mm.
A negative thought will bring you down. That's the basic principle of positive thinking. So if you have more positive thoughts, you're going to feel better. Straightforward cause and effect.
Mm.
But the flaw is in pushing yourself into only having positive thinking and driving that into an extreme. If you drive anything into an extreme, it will swing all the way back to the other extreme, because it's a pendulum movement.
Right.
So if you push yourself, push, keep pushing the positive thinking, eventually the pendulum will swing and you will swing into even deeper and darker negative thinking than you had before.
Mm.
There's no balance in it. If you drive yourself to only have all of one thing, eventually the opposite will push back and bring you back into only having the other.
Mm.
No balance. There must always be balance. So actually the goal is to recognize, okay, that was a negative thought. What's driving it? Do some healing. Look at the undercurrent. Give yourself the positive thought to step out of it for the moment, but don't keep driving the positive thinking. All you're doing is going to drive yourself ultimately into more despair, or indeed to greater denial and detachment. And then when you crash and burn, it'll be so much harder than it was before. None of these things should be done in extreme. They should always be done in balance and harmony. So though there is a nub of truth, it is also flawed by its obsessiveness.
Would you consider the repetitive use of affirmations to be a good way to use thought energy?
No, see, again, repetitiveness. That's an extreme. So once might be very effective. 100 times? You've taken away all its power. It's now got power over you, not power to do anymore.
Mm.
None of these things should be done in extreme.
Okay, well, thank you.
So little and often is better than lots and lots and lots and lots and lots.
Right. Okay. But presumably positive thinking is a good way to counter the effect of negative thinking.
But it has to be managed and realistic.
Mm.
You can't, if you force yourself to be positive all the time, you aren't healing what was causing the negativity, you're just denying it. Eventually it's going to get your attention, and when it does, you're going to be less capable of actually dealing with it.
Right, okay, thank you.
You can shut the door on a room that's on fire, but eventually the door will burn down.
Yes. Right, so I'm going to move on to the next subject then, which is issues surrounding ghost hunting. Of course, again, this is another popular thing to attend a ghost hunt.
Yes.
I suspect that people doing this probably don't realise that a ghost is not an intelligent entity there they can kind of communicate with. It's really just a psychic recording of a past event. I mean, it seems a harmless enough pastime, a bit of fun perhaps.
No, it's not harmless.
What are the possibilities of encountering a negative entity, though, when you go to one of these places?
No, but it's not harmless. Ghost hunting is not harmless.
Right.
Because you're profiting from it.
Mm.
You're profiting from the suffering of a building.
Oh, right.
So, no, if there is a ghost, as we have discussed before, this imprint of a highly emotionally charged moment in time, then if you are aware of it, clean it.
Mm.
Cleanse it. Remove it. Give the building back its peace. So hunting it, no. Don't hunt anything. You don't hunt a ghost. You're going there to commercialize a building's suffering. And the suffering of the people who are often living in that building because of the imprint, and to profit from it, or to have spectacles from it. No, don't. Clean it.
Mm.
Heal it. Cleanse it. Remove that highly charged memory from the building. Give the building back its peace. So there is a harm to ghost hunting. You are making buildings suffer.
All right, okay.
And if you make the building suffer, eventually the building will make you suffer.
Mm.
You put your consciousness into so many things and you don't even respect that you're doing it. Your energy signature sits in all sorts of manner of objects around your home and your homes themselves. And you just treat them as inanimate. Not recognizing that your own consciousness is gently seeping into them, giving them a vibrational signature and a level of consciousness that isn't sentient, but nevertheless is still consciousness.
Right. Well, thank you for that.
So,
I think many people won't realize that.
If someone has a building that has a ghost of a moment in time, an imprint, then that should be cleansed and released, and the building put back into peace. Not profited from.
Mm.
Don't profit from anything suffering, whether it is a building, a person, or an animal. There should not be profit in suffering. But that's me being very harsh. And also, I would say, overstepping the mark slightly. Because I was telling you something you should do, rather than giving you a broader opinion. My apologies. But I do find it upsetting when I see buildings who are hurting, because there is a fascination with the idea of a ghost, and so little fascination or care for the buildings that give you so much shelter.
Mm, yeah, I understand. Yeah. Okay,
I wish
you
saw buildings and objects with a little bit more respect. But then, considering how you treat plants and animals, I guess I'm asking a little too much.
Yeah, yes. Okay, right, thank you. Right, now what about the use of crystals? They do seem to offer the tempting prospect of being able to assist us in many areas of human life, but how do they work?
Basically, they are vibrational matrices. So they are amplifiers of vibrational energy, and they have their own signatures, if you like, which means that they are better for one thing than another. So think of crystals a bit like an orchestra. If you want a deep sound, you're going to hit maybe a drum. If you want a high sound, you might hit a triangle. Exactly the same could be said of crystals. If you want something that has a deep humming resonance that gives you that kind of depth of security, then you might go for tiger's eye. But if you want that crystal sharp note, that triangle note, you might go for clear quartz with its purity. So think of them like instruments, all giving off a sound, that sound being the vibration that they emit and the vibration that they absorb. So they are wonderful things. They can be just ornamental. You don't have to believe in them. You can merely admire them and appreciate them for their color. Nothing wrong with that. If you touch one and you don't feel anything, there's nothing wrong with you. Might just be that that is not the crystal for you, or might be crystals are just not for you, and you can appreciate them aesthetically. But if you touch a crystal and you do get a sense from it, if it's a sense that's good, wonderful, keep it. If it's a sense that's not good, again, maybe not the crystal for you, give it away, put it back, don't buy it, depending on the scenario. But like most things, you are very poor with your cleaning. So things that hold energy should be cleaned more regularly. So crystals, if you think about what I was just talking about with buildings, if you can't look after your crystals, you're definitely not looking after your buildings.
Okay.
You know, you build things out of natural materials. Natural materials had life in them. Anything that had life in it can continue to hold energy.
Right. I mean, what are the parameters of using crystals in terms of what they can and can't do?
Common sense, I think, is the first. You know, there is yet to be a crystal that could cure cancer, rightly so.
Yes.
So common sense. A lot of the time it is about rebalancing disharmonies. So some things that go on in your life have a proper physical cause, and those physical causes often need a physical remedy. But sometimes they are more subtle than that. They are energetic disharmonies. And then that discordance can be improved with crystals. The same as with singing, chanting, these things can also help with disharmonies, but not necessarily disease. You have to just sort of consider what it is you are suffering from. So if you are feeling low with no obvious cause, a crystal might improve your mood. But if you have suffered a deep trauma, then it might lift your mood enough that you can see a way clear to getting the help you need for the trauma. So they are useful and they are beautiful, but they are not magical in the sense that they are not miracle providers.
Right, okay, thank you. Right, well, final question then. I mean, how do you view Ouija boards and the electronic voice phenomena? I mean, are these legitimate forms of spirit communication, and what are the issues relating to using them?
Well, Ouija boards are inanimate objects that humanity have given a lot of evil intent to. So don't blame the object for how the person uses it. So for the most part, in the beginning, they were seen as a game and they were relatively harmless. Over time, they have picked up a shady reputation, and that makes them vulnerable to picking up negative energies that then manipulate the object and manipulate the people using them. So it's more about the use of it than the object itself. So a Ouija board is just that, a piece of hardboard with some letters painted on it. How it's been used and cared for determines whether or not it is advisable to use it. And for the most part, because the reasoning behind the using of it is not positive, I would suggest people leave them alone. The other one, EVP, EVP is an odd one. EVP is a lot about us just playing around a bit in the physical realm. We're always challenging ourselves to see what we can do within the physical realm, how we can I don't like the word manipulate in this scenario, but it is what we're doing. We're manipulating things, but not with an ill intent. That would be the difference. If we can affect things in the physical realm, we can give you greater assistance. That's the desire. So sometimes we play around with things like EVP, not so much because we are really trying to prove that we exist, though that is the consequence of it. People do find that as very interesting proof, but more because we are looking at what manipulation of the physical materials we can give, because that then helps us with future healing work that we might do. So it's a bit of us playing, if you like, and the benefit is for some people that gives them greater proof of survival.
Right, okay.
But our intent is not to do it because we want to prove we exist. We do it more because we are proving to ourselves we can affect the substances, the equipment, the manner in which you are capturing things.
Mm.
We aren't so bothered whether it does or does not prove our existence. That is merely a consequence for humanity.
Mm. Right. Okay, thank you. So, well, that's it. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we finish?
I think in summary with the New Age movement, I think if you are a follower of the New Age movement and it suits you, it resonates with you, then follow that path. It's a path to work. But if you are more interested in maybe some of the things that get put under its umbrella, such as angels or crystals, then follow those, listen to those. Enjoy those, but don't consider you have to then accept everything else that goes with the movement. They are all mutually exclusive. So the movement itself you might follow, or you might enjoy any of the elements that come under its umbrella. You don't have to do both. You can pick and choose. But use your discernment, use your integrity. Listen to yourself and your soul to as to which elements are right for you. The problem with anything that is a movement is people themselves tend to get the idea that, well, if I want that bit, I have to take all of it.
Mm.
And you don't. You can just take the crystals and enjoy them, or you can enjoy the movement. You have free will. Exercise it a little bit more.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Okay, so I think that is the subject finished. So I say on that note, goodbye and God bless.
Yes, God bless. Thank you for coming.
So that's the end of the recording, and as usual, I hope you've enjoyed the conversation with Master Chao.